content warning, discussing, there's a little bit of discussion of death and illness, and the spicy cough gets a mention. And yeah, there's also a little bit of, you know, children that are, the whole idea of children and disappointment, and there's a bit of philosophical kind of reflections, but as you do.
And yeah. We're having some connection issues as we record today, so if our discussion is a little glitchy, a little scratchy, we apologize. There's not much we can do about it. My audio wizardry only goes so far.
Hi, folks. This is Rue.
And Dave.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Today we continue with Madeleine L'Eng's A Wrinkle in Time and Chapter 10, Absolute Zero. There are no absolutes ever. Wait, no. Yes. So, Dave, how have you been?
Well, mentioned this a little before we started recording. I had a coffee right after I left work, and I got a mocha, and I asked for lactose-free milk, and I think they might have put regular milk in it, because, oh boy, my stomach is not liking me at the moment.
I am not going to launch into the rant that is mistakes happen. That is fine. But when there's a lack of
toes
care, hi, that's bad. When there's a lack of care when it comes to dietary considerations, and Dave, you were mentioning like some of it is also because they kind of, some things have not, don't receive the seriousness or the understanding that they deserve because, well, they're perceived as fads, or some people just do it because they think it's relevant. Yeah, it's a bit messy.
I think that's an element of it. Probably happens more towards celiac folks who can't have gluten at all. And I know gluten-free has been considered a fad by many people who are just trying to, air quotes, eat healthier. But I think, you know, often lactose-free milk and all that gets thrown in that too, which I'd say fair enough, because I probably got the numbers on, and actually, because this is more in your area of expertise, because it's a genetic thing, I think, but well, actually maybe not a tolerance thing, but I hear like, it's almost weird that lactose-free milk has only like recently within the last decade become so ubiquitous, because from my understanding, for the longest time, once a human reaches adulthood, most people's tolerance for milk and lactose goes away. They no longer have the enzymes to process it effectively.
Yeah, usually as you age, your ability to process lactose tends to drop. That being said, you've got, there's always exceptions to that rule. The thing, though, is with food intolerances, and I know that I'm a bit, probably a little sensitive to it, which is because I have a lot of food allergies and intolerances, and sometimes I just ignore them, and I and everyone else around me suffers the consequences, depending on the intolerance. But the thing is, okay, so for example, with celiac, yes, there's a population, a subsection of the population that has literally an autoimmune response. Like, it's pretty aggressive. However, there are other populations with inflammatory bowel issues that benefit from cutting gluten. There are some populations where it might not be medically well established, but it's suspected it's helping, at least anecdotally. Patients are finding that their digestive tract also improves and their energy levels improve.
Right.
So it's one of those places where it's a really difficult to, the way that we've set up medical research makes it very difficult sometimes to explore the impact of diet in a way that isn't influenced by our own preconceptions and our own understandings and all the other factors that, like, if their gastrointestinal bacteria, for example, are balanced one week and they stay on a certain dietary intake and it's fine. And then maybe they're imbalanced another week and they stay the same diet and it's not fine. And so there's all these little factors that come in that make it very difficult to assess. That's why often a person, you have to really adapt things to that person. And yes, there are some conditions where it's very obvious, like gluten plus celiac equals very bad, not fun times.
Death.
And not great. Well, eventually, yes, it's accelerating the deteriorative process of the gastrointestinal tract. It's not great. And then you've got other things, which is like allergies and people not grasping that allergies are literally the immune system throwing an atomic bomb at something that it really should not be doing.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly dangerous. And a lot of people also don't realize that there are different levels of food allergies and different types of anaphylaxis.
My lactose intolerance is relatively mild.
Yeah. Whereas I know people where lactose is very much a very bad, not good time.
Oh, a guy I work with, if he has butter, he's on the toilet that night.
Yeah, night is nice. For me, I don't want to go into too much detail, but basically dairy products and I are also not friends in most ways. So I tend to avoid it most of the time. But yeah, so there's things like that where I both get the frustration that comes from the thing, hospitality point of view, because it's like, oh yeah, no, you're fine, you'll be fine. But it's the same kind of attitude. It's very, very much the same attitude that informs when you see someone parking in a disabled car park and they're not using a wheelchair and you make assumptions about them. They've got a permit. The chances that someone is being dodgy about it, there's a small percentage chance, absolutely. But it's actually a small percentage because it's pretty damn hard to get a disability permit. It's lots of hoops. And if you have one, there is usually a reason for it. And the number of videos that you see where people are being abusive towards others and other, you're going, it's the same mentality. It's ableism. But it's a very subtle form where we feel that we can perceive what is right or wrong for another person, or whether someone is or isn't being over the top. We make so many assumptions. And I would say that if you are in the area of hospitality, you have my absolute sympathies. You are going to get some constant interactions that are not helpful. I'm not going to use the terminology, but some very entitled customers and very inappropriate conduct. At the same time, there's probably a reason why, you know, Frank no longer has dairy in their coffee, even though they used to, your regular customer Frank. And there's probably a reason why he's repeatedly saying, please make sure it's lactose free, or please make sure it's non-dairy. He's probably developed some sort of food intolerance or allergy, and that can happen. That's the other thing. People don't realize you can be not allergic to something and then develop an allergy, especially in a post-COVID world. Dear everyone, if you have been unfortunate enough to have a bout of COVID and you notice that you are not feeling well, and especially you notice you're not feeling well after certain meals, you may have developed an intolerance to certain foods, and that's just because your immune system may or may not have gone through the ringer, and which may or may not have consequences in terms of short-term, long-term modification of diet being necessary.
I've heard that happen to with pregnancy as well, like women having suddenly they develop food allergies after they've had their first or second child.
Your immune system, when it gets a bit of a pummeling, it can get confused, and that's how you also, I mean, this is very simplified and it's not entirely the whole picture, the whole story, but one aspect of it is your immune system being excessively placed in a state of distress, or it's overworked, or it's too strong. It's got into some sort of equivalent of roid rage of the immune system. There's an irony in there, but I'm not going to go into it. So it's become excessively aggressive. And sometimes that can be calmed down. Sometimes that means that it also misfires a lot more frequently. And then there's always the other direction as well. So when your immune system is also suppressed, it tries to, in some, one part is suppressed, the other one tries to compensate, as well, other part compensates. So it's a really delicate balance. There is some, we have a lot of robustness. Our human body is tough. It can go through a lot, but there is constant balance. And sometimes it benefits from dietary modification. Sometimes that won't do anything. But so go back to your point that you, that someone that you ended up with possible lactose in your drink, it sucks. And yes, it's frustrating from a hospitality point of view, but from customer point of view, if you are lucky, if someone's asking for a non-dairy version and you give them something dairy, so not lactose-free lactose, if you gave them dairy, you have to hope they don't have a serious, like, and all responses, all allergies, intolerances are uncomfortable and serious and disruptive. That's sure. Mm. But in terms of deadly serious. So you have to be conscious about it. And I will gauge, for example, as someone who does have some pretty bad allergies, I will gauge the quality and the standard of a chef by how well, how they respond to being asked. And I will ask ahead of time usually, so I don't bother them. Do you have this and this in your food? Because I would rather not have an anaphylactic reaction here in the middle of your restaurant. I would rather not die, but I also don't want to, this is funny, I don't want to be, you know, inconsiderate and disrupt your place of, it's a very weird thing. Like, if I die, I die. Okay, like, I can't do anything about it. I'm doing what I can to prevent it, but I can't stop that from happening if it's going to happen. Yeah? It's not nihilism, it's more, well, look, if it happens, what can you do? So what you do is you try and avoid the scenario from arising to begin with by doing what you can control. So, but for me, it's like, oh no, I don't want to disrupt your business. I mean, it would be very inconvenient because it's not just me. It's there are people earning their money. There are people enjoying a meal. I don't want to be the one who, you know, spoils their life. That would suck as a legacy. So yes, it's a very strange, strange approach, but I guess it works.
But, you just don't order a shellfish.
No. Well, yeah, I have to be careful. But yeah, so there's the thing. When you, now anyone working in hospitality industry, I guess the heads up is you are going to find that a lot more people are going to have, especially the whole gluten-free, dairy-free business or lactose-free, that's going to go up because people are going to experiment with what seems to make them feel better or have more energy or not feel as unwell. So that's going to happen, and be prepared, much like Scar suggests.
Now that's Jeremy irony.
Yeah. In the meantime, yeah. So it's yeah. So last episode, Dave, what do you recall from last episode?
Last time, so many books, so little time.
And we apologize. There was a bit of a delay that. It happens.
It's been happening a lot lately. We're discussing maybe how to change that in the future, but we will get into that once we know what we're doing.
Yes.
We are aware.
We can blame how my body responded to physio last week. That can go into that list.
But let's see. What do I remember? Well, they met the brain.
We met it.
Meg was failing to withstand its onslaught. Calvin yelled for her father to take her and test her, which he did. Kind of, I don't want to say unsuccessfully, but it sounds like it wasn't a pleasant experience. Not that it was when the missuses tested them, but, you know, compared to the missuses, Meg does mention that this was nowhere near that level of competency.
No.
So,
which, I mean, fair, if you're a few billion years old, you probably have it down pat.
You probably know a thing or two.
You'd hope, yes.
Imagine living for billions of years and you've just like refused to learn anything.
Wow. Yeah, no.
But what was it? Before then, Yeah, she went into the column. Meg went into the column because she used the spectacles that the Mrs. Watson, I believe, gave her.
Mrs. Who's spectacles.
Okay. And got her father. They went out. Charles Wallace was very rude towards him. Meg thinks he doesn't understand that Charles Wallace is not Charles Wallace. But I think he's kind of coming to terms with that, because from the sound of it, he's had his own run-ins with it and being the person. Well, we kind of don't know exactly. All we really know about Mr. Murray is what Meg has kind of told us about.
Yeah. And the Mrs. is technically, because they did indicate that he's someone who fights the darkness.
Yeah. I mean, we get the impression he's very intelligent, probably quite switched on. To be able to go and do this, he's got either a sense of curiosity or bravery or both. I get the feeling he takes things in stride because, you know, he did try a bit of authority on Charles Wallace from the perspective of being his father. And when that didn't work, he kind of just tried a different tack, it felt like.
Problem solving. He tends to go for the problem solving, which is not always an appropriate approach, but yes.
Yeah, I get the feeling that he is quite switched on. He's going to be an asset rather than a liability for the rest of this book. But you know, this is mainly Meg's story, and she's kind of, I mean, she's wrestling with the fact that she felt that once she found her father, he would make everything all right. And now she's had to come to terms with the fact that that is not the case.
No. And that there seems to be a lot more, like there's something that more needs to be done. Like there's not, so you can't rely, oddly enough, there's a way that I was also framing in my mind is you can't rely on others for your hope.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you need to nurture and encourage within yourself. You can look at others and look at their actions and all that, and like the Mr. Rogers look to the helpers kind of situation. Mm-hmm. But for you to be the helper, you can't rely on others to do the helping for you. You have to be the one who wants to go and help.
Yeah, the only thing you can look to others for is inspiration, which is a personal thing as well, because the actions of who another person is enacting change within you, or a desire in you to help or change or whatever they're inspiring you to do, because the word inspiration generally means positive.
Yeah. And I think that can be a thing that you can, that's one of the things you can seek from others, but also not something, again, that you need to depend, like, it might not, if you only turn to others for hope and for inspiration, then you miss out on actually, like, the situation with Meg, where she's gone, she's hoping that, like, well, her hope was that she goes there and Dad fixes everything.
Mm.
But that wasn't the way it works out, and that's not the way it's working out. So it's a bit of a being confronted with the reality that that's not the way things pan out.
And if I remember, she's like 12, right?
I want to say she's 12 or 13. So she is that age where you realize increasingly that your parents don't know absolutely
everything. That was the point I was getting at, because it really did feel like that. And we talked a little about it last episode, where one of the shakings off of childhood is when you first realize that your parents are fallible and human, that they can't just solve everything and that they don't know everything. And that can be quite a confronting, infuriating realization.
Yeah. And I think sometimes that's one of the...
I was going to say, because they have, for a lot of us, they have held such authority.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you've been acting in charge and yet you don't know what you're doing.
And I think that depending on how they have enacted on authority and how they have raised and how all these things come in and how that also is addressed. If you model, a friend of mine was talking about modeling for their kids, that they don't always have all the solutions and how to actually come about with making a decision and involving them in this, the decision-making process. So it's not about, I know what needs to be done X, Y, Z, and therefore let's do it, but more, okay, so what is the challenge? What are the things we need to consider? Let's think about it. Let's work together. And of course, there'll be moments where it's like the parents have to make a choice and that happens, like safety. Sometimes that can be a thing. But other things like, oh, I don't know how fast the sun spins. Let's look that up together. Let's find that out together. Like this moments of, I'm not sure. Let me think about it and modeling that. And like, oh, that didn't work out. That didn't work out. Let's try something new. So having that kind of modeling is really important because that way that void or that gap between a child recognizing their parent as a fallible being.
And also, very importantly, I think, realizing that not knowing something isn't the end of the world.
Yes. And I think that that's a huge, like, huge blessing you can give any kid. I think even as an adult, if you aren't a parent and if you just happen to be an adult and you are in a role where you happen to be, you know, an uncle, an auntie, a neighbor or whatever, even going, oh, I don't know. Let me look that up. I'm not sure. I'll need to research that. I'll have to find out. Do you know something about it? Would you like to share what you know about it or what you think it might be? Actually opening them up to being able to express themselves as well. It's really good. So, it's things like that I really enjoy about this book because it is addressing that topic. Like even with Charles Wilson, you can't know absolutely everything. And it's okay to want to know, but you can't be so attached to knowing that your pride comes first. And your awareness of a situation comes last. Like, yeah. It's fascinating. Like there's layers to this. But yeah.
And he, his desire to know put them in danger.
When we make decisions and make choices, that we need to be a lot more aware of the potential impact and context.
Yeah.
Very much so. Context is key. So yes, but today's chapter, yes, we have tessered. There has been tessering and she's in the darkness of complete unconsciousness. She's passed out from the pain of it. And we have a chapter called Absolute Zero. Now, Absolute Zero being a scientific reference, because it's Absolute Zero is the moment at which particles do not move. So atoms don't move, like the idea of particular, like where the particulate matter is like it stops, no movement, and that's pretty cold. Was it -271.4 Kelvin? I want to say, I can't remember. I'm going to find out. Oh wait, no, it'd be zero Kelvin. It'd be degrees. -271. 0.4 degrees, I think. -271.4 degrees Celsius. I got that wrong because it's been a while. I'll find it. Absolute zero. I need to know because it's stuck in my head. See, not everything needs to be known, except I really need to know. okay. Yes. 273.15. That's close. That's close. It's been a while since I've taught chemistry. And for our Fahrenheit users, because you exist, minus...
The disdain.
-459.67 Fahrenheit. I don't understand Fahrenheit, but it's okay.
Look, I come from the US. I don't understand Fahrenheit.
It's confusing. So, yes. So absolute zero is a temperature in which a thermodynamic system has lowest energy. As said, -273.15 degrees Celsius. And it's a bit chilly.
Just a tad.
So zero Kelvin. I don't know why I said, never mind. You can correct me. You can all mock me. mock me for my terrible recollection there.
Now, I don't think you'd feel the cold at zero Kelvin, right? Because you'd be dead.
You'd be more than dead. You'd be bad. It would be bad. So things like oxygen, I think, freezes at, oh gosh, negative 200, honestly. Oxygen liquid, yeah, freezing point or liquid. Negative 218.8. So that's not great. Not great.
Yeah, the idea of oxygen freezing in your lungs.
Yeah, no. Yeah, solid oxygen forms at this is normal atmospheric pressure, mind you, so it's not in a vacuum, then it gets even it's different. 54.36 Kelvin, so that's like negative 218.79. It is very cold. That's negative 361.82 Fahrenheiters. So yes, it gets cold.
Well,
I didn't pronounce the Fahrenheit with an emphasis on the F, but so it's yeah, it's cold. So it would yes. So it seems the fact that they have referred to the temperature at which thermodynamic conditions do not exist essentially is a bit of a portent. It's portentous.
Well, we also seem to be, you know, at the point in the book where things might look their bleakest.
Well, absolute zero. That's true.
Okay, well, let us see what transpires.
Yes. Chapter 10, Absolute Zero. The first sign of returning consciousness was called, then sound. She was aware of voices that seemed to be traveling through her across an arctic waste. Slowly the icy sounds cleared, and she realized that the voices belonged to her father and Calvin. She did not hear Charles Wallace. She tried to open her eyes, but the lids would not move. She tried to sit up, but she could not stir. She struggled to turn over, to move her hands, her feet, but nothing happened. She knew that she had a body, but it was as lifeless as marble. She heard Calvin's frozen voice. Her heart is beating so slowly. Her father's voice. But it's beating. She's alive. Barely. We couldn't find a heartbeat at all at first. We thought she was dead. Yes. And then we could feel her heart very faintly, the beats very far apart. And then it got stronger. So all we have to do is wait. Her father's words sounded brittle in her ears, as though they were being chipped out of ice. Calvin, yes, you're right, sir. She wanted to call out to them, I'm alive, I'm very much alive, only I've been turned to stone. But she could not call out any more than she could move. Calvin's voice again. Anyhow, you got her away from it. You got us both away, and we couldn't have gone on holding out. It's so much more powerful and strong than... How did we stay out, sir? How did we manage as long as we did? Her father. Because it's completely unused to being refused. That's the only reason I could keep from being absorbed too. No mind has tried to hold out against it for so many thousands of centuries that certain centers have become soft and atrophied through lack of use. If you hadn't come to me when you did, I'm not sure how much longer I would have lasted. I was on the point of giving in. Calvin, oh no, sir. Her father, yes. Nothing seemed important anymore but rest. And of course, it offered me complete rest. I had almost come to the conclusion that I was wrong to fight, that it was right after all, and everything I believed in most passionately was nothing but a madman's dream. But then you and Meg came in to me, broke through my prison, and hope and faith returned. Calvin. Sir, why were you on Kamazots at all? Was there a particular reason for going there? Her father, with a frigid laugh. Going to Kamazots was a complete accident. I never intended even to leave our own solar system. I was heading for Mars. Tessering is even more complicated than we had expected. Calvin, sir, how was it able to get Charles Wallace before it got Meg and me? Her father, from what you've told me, it's because Charles Wallace thought he could deliberately go into it and return. He trusted too much to his own strength. Listen, I think the heartbeat is getting stronger. His words no longer sounded to her quite as frozen. Was it his words that were her eyes or her ears? Why did she hear only her father and Calvin? Why didn't Charles Wallace speak? Silence, a long silence. Then Calvin's voice again. Can't we do anything? Can't we look for help? Do we just have to go on waiting? Her father. We can't leave her, and we must stay together. We must not be afraid to take time. Calvin. You mean we were? We rushed into things on Kamazots too fast, and Charles Wallace rushed in too fast, and that's why he got caught? Maybe. I'm not sure. I don't know enough yet. Time is different on Kamazots anyhow. Our time, inadequate though it is, at least is straightforward. It may not be even fully one-dimensional, because it can't move back and forth on its line, only ahead, but at least it's consistent in its direction.
That's an interesting idea.
Time on Kamazot seems to be inverted, turned in on itself. So I have no idea whether I was imprisoned in that column for centuries or only for minutes. Silence for a moment. Then her father's voice again. I think I feel a pulse in her wrist now. Meg could not feel his fingers against her wrist. She could not feel her wrist at all. Her body was still stone, but her mind was beginning to be capable of movement. She tried desperately to make some kind of a sound, a signal to them, but nothing happened. Their voices started again. Calvin, about your project, sir. Were you on it alone? Her father, oh no, there were half a dozen of us working on it, and I dare say a number of others we don't know about. Certainly we weren't the only nation to investigate along that line. It's not really a new idea, but we did try very hard not to let it be known abroad that we were trying to make it practicable. Did you come to Kamazots alone, or were there others with you? I came alone. You see, Calvin, there was no way to try it out ahead with rats or monkeys or dogs, and we had no idea whether it would really work or whether it would be a complete bodily disintegration. Playing with time and space is a dangerous game. But why you, sir? I wasn't the first. We drew straws and I was second. What happened to the first man? We don't... Look, did her eyelids move? Silence, then. No, it was only a shadow. But I did blink, Meg tried to tell them. I'm sure I did, and I can hear you. Do something. But there was only another long silence, during which perhaps they were looking at her, watching for another shadow, another flicker. Then she heard her father's voice again, quiet, a little warmer, more like his own voice. We drew straws, and I was second. We know Hank went. We saw him go. We saw him vanish right in front of the rest of us. He was there, and then he wasn't. We were to wait for a year for his return, or for some message. We waited. Nothing. Calvin, his voice cracking. Jeepers, sir, you must have been in sort of a flap. Her father, yes, it's a frightening as well as an exciting thing to discover that matter and energy are the same thing, that size is an illusion, and that time is a material substance. We can know this, but it's far more than we can understand with our puny little brains. I think you will be able to comprehend far more than I, and Charles Wallace even more than you. Yes, but what happened, please, sir, after the first man? Meg could hear her father sigh. Then it was my turn. I went, and here I am, a wiser and humbler man. I am sure I haven't been gone 2 years. Now that you've come, I have some hope that I may be able to return in time. One thing I have to tell the others is that we know nothing. Calvin, what do you mean, sir? Father, just what I say. We're children playing with dynamite. In our mad rush, we've plunged into this before. With a desperate effort, Meg made a sound. It wasn't a very loud sound, but it was a sound. Mr. Murray stopped. Hush, listen. Meg made a strange croaking noise. She found that she could pull open her eyelids. They felt heavier than marble, but she managed to raise them. Her father and Calvin were hovering over her. She did not see Charles Wallace. Where was he? She was lying in an open field of what looked like rusty, stubby grass. She blinked slowly and with difficulty. Meg, her father said, Meg, are you all right? Her tongue felt like a stone tongue in her mouth, but she managed to croak. I can't move. Try, Calvin urged. He sounded now as though he were very angry with her. Wiggle your toes. Wiggle your fingers. I can't. Where's Charles Wallace? Her words were blunted by the stone tongue. Perhaps they could not understand her, for there was no answer. We were knocked out for a minute, too, Calvin was saying. You'll be all right, Meg. Don't get panicky. He was crouched over her, and though his voice continued to sound cross, he was peering at her with anxious eyes. She knew she must still have her glasses on, because she could see him clearly, his freckles, his stubby black lashes, the bright blue of his eyes. Her father was kneeling on her other side. The round lenses of Mrs. Hu's glasses still blurred his eyes. He took one of her hands and rubbed it between his. Can you feel my fingers? He sounded quite calm, as though there were nothing extraordinary in having her completely paralyzed. At the quiet of his voice, she felt calmer. Then she saw there were great drops of sweat standing out on his forehead, and she noticed vaguely that the gentle breeze that touched her cheeks was cool. At first his words had been frozen, and now the wind was mild. Was it icy cold here, or warm? Can you feel my fingers? He asked again. Yes, now she could feel a pressure against her wrist, but she could not nod. Where's Charles Wallace? Her words were a little less blurred. Her tongue, her lips, were beginning to feel cold and numb, as though she had been given a massive dose of Novocaine at the dentist. She realized with a start that her body and limbs were cold, that not only was she not warm, she was frozen from head to toe, and it was this that had made her father's words seem like ice, that had paralyzed her. I'm frozen, she said faintly. Camazotz hadn't been this cold, a cold that cut deeper than the wind on the bitterest of winter days at home. She was away from it, but this unexplained iciness was almost as bad. Her father had not saved her. Now she was able to look around a little, and everything she could see was rusty and grey. There were trees edging the field in which she lay, and their leaves were the same brown as the grass. There were plants that might have been flowers, except they were dull and grey. In contrast to the drabness of colour, to the cold that numbed her, the air was filled with a delicate spring-like fragrance, almost imperceptible, as it blew softly against her face. She looked at her father and Calvin. They were both in their shirt sleeves, and they looked perfectly comfortable. It was she, wrapped in their clothes, who was frozen too solid even to shiver. "Why am I so cold?" she asked. "Where's Charles Wallace?" They did not answer. "Father, where are we?" Mr. Murray looked at her soberly. "I don't know, Meg. I don't test her very well. I must have overshot somehow. We're not on Camazotz. I don't know where we are. I think you're so cold because we went through the black thing, and I thought for a moment it was going to tear you away from me." "Is this a dark planet?" Slowly her tongue was beginning to thaw. Her words were less blurred. "I don't think so," Mr. Murray said, "but I know so little about anything that I can't be sure." "You shouldn't have tried to test her then." She had never spoken to her father in this way before. The words seemed hardly to be hers. Calvin looked at her, shaking his head. "It was the only thing to do. At least it got us off Camazotz." "Why did we go without Charles Wallace? Did we just leave him there?" The words that were not really hers came out cold and accusing. "We didn't just leave him," her father said. "Remember that the human brain is a very delicate organism, and that it can be easily damaged." "See, Meg," Calvin crouched over her, tense and worried. "If your father had tried to yank Charles away when he tethered us, and if it had kept grabbing hold of Charles, it might have been too much for him. and we'd have lost him forever. And we had to do something right then. Why? It was taking us. You and I were slipping. And if your father had gone on trying to help us, he wouldn't have been able to hold out much longer either. You told him to Tesser. Meg charged Calvin. There isn't any question of blame, Mr. Murray cut in severely. Can you move yet? All Meg's faults were uppermost in her now, and they were no longer helping her. No, and you'd better take me back to Camazotz and Charles Wallace quickly. You're supposed to be able to help. Disappointment was as dark and corrosive in her as the black thing. The ugly words tumbled from her cold lips, even as she herself could not believe that it was to her father, her beloved, longed-for father, that she was talking to in this way. If her tears had not still been frozen, they would have gushed from her eyes. She had found her father, and he had not made everything all right. Everything kept getting worse and worse. If the long search for her father was ended, and he wasn't able to overcome all their difficulties, there was nothing to guarantee that it would come out all right in the end. There was nothing left to hope for. She was frozen, and Charles Wallace was being devoured by it, and her omnipotent father was doing nothing. She teetered on the seesaw of love and hate, and the black thing pushed her down into hate. "You don't even know where we are," she cried out at her father. "We'll never see Mother or the twins again. We don't know where Earth is, or even where Camazotz is. We're lost out in space. What are you going to do?" She did not realize that she was as much in the power of the black thing as Charles Wallace. Mr. Murray bent over her, massaging her cold fingers. She could not see his face. "My daughter, I'm not a Mrs. Watsit, a Mrs. Who, or a Mrs. Witch. Yes, Calvin has told me everything he could. I am a human being, and a very fallible one, but I agree with Calvin. We were sent here for something, and we know that all things work together for good, to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose." "The black thing," Meg cried out at him. "Why did you let it almost get me?" "You've never tessered as well as the rest of us," Calvin reminded her. "It never bothered Charles and me as much as it did you." "He shouldn't have taken me then," Meg said, "until he learned to do it better." Neither her father nor Calvin spoke. Her father continued his gentle massage. Her fingers came back to life with tingling pain. "You're hurting me." "Then you're feeling again," her father said quietly. "I'm afraid it is going to hurt, Meg." The piercing pain moved slowly up her arms, began in her toes and legs. She started to cry out against her father when Calvin exclaimed, "Look!" Coming toward them, moving in silence across the brown grass, were three figures. What were they? On Uriel there had been the magnificent creatures. On Camazotz the inhabitants had at least resembled people. What were these three strange things approaching? They were the same dull grey colour as the flowers. If they hadn't walked upright, they would have seemed like animals. They moved directly toward the three human beings. They had four arms and far more than five fingers to each hand, and the fingers were not fingers but long waving tentacles. They had heads and they had faces, but where the faces of the creatures on Uriel had seemed far more than human faces, these seemed far less. Where the features would normally be there were several indentations, and in place of ears and hair were more tentacles. They were tall, Meg realized as they came closer, far taller than any man. They had no eyes, just soft indentations. Meg's rigid, frozen body tried to shudder with terror, but instead of the shudder, all that came was pain. She moaned. The things stood over them. They appeared to be looking down at them, except that they had no eyes with which to see. Mr. Murray continued to kneel by Meg, massaging her. "He's killed us, bringing us here," Meg thought. "I'll never see Charles Wallace again, or Mother, or the twins." Calvin rose to his feet. He bowed to the beasts as though they could see him. He said, "How do you do, sir, ma'am?" "Who are you?" the tallest of the beasts said. His voice was neither hostile nor welcoming, and it came not from the mouth like indentations in the furry face, but from the waving tentacles. They'll eat us, Meg thought wildly. They're making me hurt. My toes, my fingers, I hurt. Calvin answered the beast's question. We're from Earth. I'm not sure how we got here. We've had an accident. Meg, this girl, is paralyzed. She can't move. She's terribly cold. We think that's why she can't move. One of them came up to Meg and squatted down on its huge haunches beside her, and she felt utter loathing and revulsion as it reached out a tentacle to touch her face. But with the tentacle came the same delicate fragrance that moved across her with the breeze, and she felt a soft, tingling warmth go all through her that momentarily assuaged her pain. She felt suddenly sleepy. I must look as strange to it as it looks to me, she thought drowsily, and then realized with a shock that of course the beast couldn't see her at all. Nevertheless, a reassuring sense of safety flowed through her with the warmth which continued to seep deep into her as the beast touched her. Then it picked her up, cradling her in two of its forearms. Mr. Murray stood up quickly. What are you doing? Taking the child.
Dun, dun, dun.
And yes.
I do like that little side there that Meg's like, oh, wait, I probably look as horrifying to it as it does to me. And you know what? It probably can't even see me anyway.
Yeah. So it's I noticed that she is horrified with how she's speaking to her dad.
Hmm.
And at the same time, she's acknowledging that it's the influence of that black thing, that it's letting out the worst of her.
Mm.
Her worst traits are being her worst. But yeah, there's many things. The not brain, it makes sense why they didn't bring Charles, as his brain is being torn apart by it.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that they brought Calvin, because I just assumed, at least from last chapter, that he grabbed Meg and split.
No, I think he probably had enough time to grab Calvin. I don't think he let go of Calvin. I think he was holding on to him the whole time.
Right.
But yeah. But here it is as well. It's like disappointment is being dark and corrosive.
Hmm.
So things that make you lose hope, that is essentially what... It's harmful. Anything it robs you of hope. Anything that, yeah.
We got more of basically explicitly the idea that, yeah, part of the problem is that in her mind, Mr. Murray was meant to solve everything and he hasn't been able to. So yeah. She's losing hope because she had so much hope in that idea and it didn't plan out. And now she's like, well, what are we supposed to do? And that's when also the anger takes over. You're like, well, you left Charles Wallace there. We don't know where we are. Yeah.
I can't move. I'm in pain. I'm frozen. Like, yeah, it's not being able to deal with that distress because it's just layer and layer and layer of distress. And it's interesting that also the way that Mr. Murray, we're getting glimpses of Mr. Murray kind of going, we didn't know what we were doing. Like we were playing around like a kid with dynamite. Like it's playing around with these concepts. And I think that there is, you don't want to promote anti-intellectualism. You don't want to promote anti-science and things like that. I don't agree with that kind of a thing. However, it's when you are, again, we come back to that whole, when you're making a decision that you think about what the impact, the possible impact, and not to assume. Mr. Murray pointed out the reason Charles Wallace got taken was because Charles Wallace thought he could handle it.
He believed in his own strength too much.
Yes. And I mean, this is what Mr. Murray is saying. Like, that's why, was it Hank or Henry? Hank?
Hank, I think it was.
Hank didn't come back. And yet we continue to do it.
Hmm. Definitely because of when this was written, I think the shadow of the atomic bomb is definitely an influence to this idea.
Yep. Also, this is literally, we couldn't use rats or dogs or whatever. And that's a reference directly to the space race.
Mm.
Also, this idea that there's different nations working on the same thing, but they're all keeping things away from each other. you'd think if you're playing around with big things like time and space, you'd have global consensus in terms of everyone working together towards it, which is why things like, you know, the CERN Super Collider or some things are even, yeah. So there's this idea of when is something that is has the profound impact on the entirety of humanity, then you'd want to collaborate with people from different perspectives as well.
Because wasn't, I mean, it's shown that that has not been a concern, but one of the concerns of the particle accelerator was, well, what if we slam these two particles together and we create like a mini black hole and it grows? I mean...
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a zero possibility, but it's an extremely unlikely, like beyond unlikely. Yeah, it's like... almost unlikely to the point of impossible. But yeah, that kind of decision, if you're going to do something that has the potential impact to completely eradicate all human life.
Yes.
Going
back to Oppenheimer.
Yeah, going back to the atomic bomb. And the problem is that when we use something, we refine the technology to cause harm. And I mean, even the technology that is not designed to cause harm can be harmful if it lacks the ethical and... the ethical framework to inform its use and design.
Yeah.
And ethics, we know, differ from depending on the cultural context. It gets really, yeah. And this is why it's really, there are layers to this that are really well, that you have a man of science who's going, there are things we don't understand and I know nothing. Right? We know nothing. And two, we should have learned it from the, basically kind of like we should have learned from the first person being lost. We should have learned from that. But we were like too eager, too arrogant, too excited, too assumptive.
He did say that Tessering himself and winding up on Kamazov, it's a very humbling process for him.
Yeah. And that he completely had no idea what he was doing. Like he could have ended up on a one-dimensional planet.
Or in a sun.
In the sun. Yeah. I mean, the fact that he was aiming for Mars, but doesn't know what it's like to be on the surface of Mars.
Well, yeah, that's kind of, I mean, okay, this written in the late 50s, early 60s. But yeah, knowing what we know now, that's a ridiculous concept.
And I mean, he could have, the thing is, they might have had a space suit and all sorts of stuff. Mm. But still... Mm.
Yeah.
It's like you could have landed in a crater. You don't know what, like a volcano, middle of Jupiter, and being squished into a sludge. Like it's a ridiculous kind of approach.
I mentioned it as you read it. I'll probably expand on the idea a little now. When he talks about, you know, our concept of time, to be honest, it really isn't even one dimensional. It can't move back and forth on its plane. It only goes forward.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
We have human in terms of the way that we work with time in our aspect of the universe, so to speak. Yeah, it's one directional. It's unidirectional.
Where he says on Kamazov, it seems to inverge in on itself. He's like, yeah, I don't know how long I was in that column. It could have been centuries.
Yeah. So there's things like, how time is perceived, how time is experienced, how matter is. I mean, these are all very much extreme kind of experimental concept. The fact that you can't really have a one-dimensional planet in a three-dimensional universe. That's not a thing. But for the sake of the book, that's, you know, we'll go there. The fact that he's gone, well, matter is this idea that time is actually solid is material. So there's some interesting kind of little reflections. And I like how Calvin goes, hey, mate, remember, you don't test her well. So, that combination with Mr. Murray being a complete and utter kid in a sandbox of the universe.
It ends with, you know, them take the creatures they found taking Meg, and judging by the next chapter being called Ant Beast, I'm thinking these are not malevolent creatures.
Well, so far we are seeing also from the way that they interact. I mean, it could be an evolutionary thing, that when she's being touched by the creature, that she's feeling safe and, mm-hmm. and at ease, and the pain is reducing. So that's hopefully a good sign.
I also, like when it originally said there were three coming over, and Calvin or Meg made the comparison to Unuriel, they look like this. And I was thinking, oh, is this the Mrs.'s in a new form?
Mm. Well, that's the thing. Like, you've got this, you've got this idea of these, they're dull gray. They don't like, they don't say anything.
But they could just be, you know, like, it seems that binary-wise, the universe seems to be split in, you know, agents of good, agents of chaos, that kind of thing.
Maybe. But there's also, they're saying, like, they don't look, so this is about their appearance. So Camazotz, they looked like people. Uriel, they looked magnificent. What were they say? They looked like this. They looked, if they weren't upright, I would have thought they're animals. So you've got this whole animals, they've got four arms and five fingers on each hand, and it's more than five fingers, and the fingers are tentacles. So they've got four arms with tentacles at the end.
Yeah, and indentations where
and
their face
their
should
heads,
be.
Heads instead of, yeah, indentations where their face should be. So there's like where the creature faces on the creatures in Uriel had seemed far more than human faces. These seemed far less. So they have no feature. They've got indentations, no facial features, and they've got tentacles instead of ears and hair.
And when they talked, it seemed to be coming from the tentacles.
Yes, that's what it sounded like.
And Calvin, so once again, being the communicator, went up to them and it's like, hi.
Well, yeah, and that's his role. His role is to be the communicator, as he's been told by the W's, the three W's. WWW. That's terrible. I just realized that. But yes. So the Mrs.'s or the W's. And so now we've got, there's a lot of, I like the fact that you've got this concept of humility and of not necessarily, and also this contrast of this hopelessness and at the end that ease. Ease, like easing the pain from a source that you would not expect, like a completely unfamiliar, I don't know how to process this kind of, this is something new, oh no, something else is going to go wrong, oh no, and then just like calm. But yes, next chapter is chapter 11 with Aunt Beast.
We're very close to the end of the book. I think we've only got like two chapters left.
Yeah, we're up to 83%, so we are very, very close. It's not that many pages left, not many chapters left. But yeah, so we have a situation where Charles Wallace is stuck on Camazotz. Yeah. How did you like the description of why it was, why they were able to resist it? Like, remember saying, why is it that Calvin and Meg and the father could resist it?
Oh, because it wasn't used to being resisted, and that aspect of its makeup might have atrophied over time from not being in use.
Yeah, and then you've got Charles Wallace, who the only reason it managed to get in was because
he welcomed
it. Yeah.
That is an interesting idea that its sales pitch, as it were, is so persuasive that it never really needed to do more than lie, I guess.
And also it's almost getting to the point where Mr. Murray was about to give in. So as soon as you lose hope, of course, peace and never having to think again and never having to worry again sounds wonderful. When you have no hope, then you do whatever it is that makes you feel to get rid of that pain or that void or that discomfort.
And
there are parallels. Yes.
I think it is a link to a lack of hope, which I'd call despair. But, you know, when he said I was starting to question my own, you know, whether everything I believed in is a lie. I forget the actual words.
It's just the musings of a madman.
Yeah, that idea that you know, it's often said that it's a sign of wisdom to always kind of have doubt in your beliefs or what you're saying. But I mean, it's probably healthy to not completely believe 100% in everything you hold to be true or what you say. But I think that can be destructive as well.
It brings us back. So before the recordings, I was talking about a Twitter post that I made, which was about this idea of you have to be open to the possibility that you are wrong. Mm. You might not be, and that's totally fine. But when you're making a decision, you have to consider, but if I'm wrong, what is the worst case scenario? Mm. And it's the same way with our beliefs. So like if I have a belief in actions of kindness are something that are beneficial to society, I'd have to see evidence or have lessons that teach me that it is, or like give me the indication, experiences that no, actions of kindness are not actually that helpful to society. Being kind to society is not actually helpful. It does nothing, makes no difference. But I can't be, like, you can't be certain. The evidence base for that would be shaky because it's based on opinion and not necessarily, it's not like you can go through the entire civilization and know absolutely every action of kindness. So it's a very vague example. But that idea that you have to, however, be open to the possibility that you are wrong in order to be able to make a choice that is informed of impact and what could happen. And also, otherwise, you're not open to the idea of learning something new based on new experiences and new information. Basically, what I ended up describing is it's a form of the scientific process, but it was taking it back to its base philosophy in the sense that you need to be explorative in your mindset. Hmm. But yeah, same thing here. You've got this whole idea of, not that it's necessarily self-doubt, but with Mr. Murray, I don't know if it was like, what if he's wrong and it wasn't the musings of a madman? What if he's wrong? What's the impact? Well, others would, that I might feel better by letting go and just giving up and giving into it. But in terms of what impact would that have on those that I love? Mm. So that was the whole, yeah. And I think that's why he was saying, if you guys hadn't turned up when you did, it would have been it, because we needed to see.
I imagine also that part of its attack on Mr. Murray was like, you're trapped here. You'll never see your family again. And then who should show up but Meg?
Yeah. Or like, you're never going to see your family again and they'll have forgotten you by now and blah, 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 like, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm interested to see what these creatures, how they help Meg and how they get back and how they defeat it, or at least, you know, at this point, it's like not so much defeating it. It's more about rescuing Charles Wallace.
To some extent, yes. So we will see how it goes. But in the meantime, we shall wrap up for this episode and continue. And we'll catch up next time. Hopefully. We will see how it goes. Hopefully it'll be within a week. But look, yes, depending on life. So in the meantime, the music at the top of the podcast was by Jeff Danner. It's a score for the 2003 production of A Wrinkle in Time. The music at the end of the podcast is I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me on Twitter at Rue McMoo.
And I am over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip. You can find our Twitter profile and our Facebook page at SMBSLTpodcast. And if you would like to email us, it is SMBSLTpodcast@gmail.com. We welcome your feedback. We'd love to hear from you regarding what you think of the episodes, what you think of the book, if you have suggestions for books you'd like us to read in the future, and if you just want to say hello. Also, if you listen to the podcast on any platform that allows you to rate and or review it, we would appreciate that as well.
And thus we continue as time progresses. I'm having a reference to the out of, oh no, as days of our lives, as something about time.
Sands through the hourglass.
That's it. Sands through the hourglass of time, something, days of our lives. Okay, sorry. That was a very weird side note. But yes, and on that note, we will wrap up and we'll catch up next time. Thank you.
Enjoy your reading, folks. Stay safe. Bye.